This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In the news this week, big stories of disaster and turmoil abroad were hard to ignore back home in Massachusetts. 1 week after a powerful earthquake and tsunami, Japan struggled with a nuclear catastrophe.
And the crisis at the Fukushima nuclear reactors prompted new concerns about nuclear plants across the U.S. and in New England.
And after prodding by members of the international community and here at home by the likes of Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, the United Nations voted to impose a no-fly zone over Libya. Today, Libya responded.
Libya has decided an immediate ceasefire and the stoppage of all military operations.
But it might be too little, too late, as less than an hour ago, President Barack Obama responded.
Muammar Gaddafi clearly lost the confidence of his own people and the legitimacy to lead. Instead of respecting the rights of his own people, Gaddafi chose the path of brutal suppression.
Also this week, Governor Deval Patrick flew home from his overseas job creation trip as Fidelity Investments announced it's moving jobs out of state.
Let me just say something about the Fidelity announcement. I'm not just disappointed, I'm frustrated.
And here to discuss the week's news is Clayton Jones, chief editorial writer of the Christian Science Monitor. Clay, good to have you. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
We're also expecting Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, but we haven't yet established the connection with the Boston Globe Bureau, but that will be happening. But let's go first to Libya, where last night the streets were packed in Benghazi, with Libyans celebrating the UN Security Council vote to authorize military intervention and to impose a no-fly zone over the country. And then today, President Barack Obama, just a few moments ago, said the Gaddafi government must pull back from specific towns and stop advancing on Benghazi. He also said the government must allow humanitarian aid to get through to civilians and offered a clear ultimatum. President Obama went on to say the U.S. is not going to send ground troops into Libya and that the goal here is strictly to protect civilians. Let's go to you, Clayton Jones. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the U.S. is not responsive or impressed. We just heard President Obama there by the ceasefire talk. So now that the U.N. has resolved to intervene, must it follow up?
I think it's on a steady course to actually get some action on the ground. What we're seeing here is two things. One is a humanitarian response to try and prevent a massacre in Benghazi and elsewhere in Libya. But also it's a little muddled by where Obama stands on the political aspect of this, the Arab Spring. Does he really want to create democracy in Libya? And if so, is it going to take more than just a no-fly zone?
Mm. And isn't there, what's the risk, too? Because if imposing a no-fly zone, it sounds okay out of the gate, but if it's not successful, then what?
Well, the UN also said all possible means could be used, and so that could go farther. We do know that Egypt has already started supplying the rebels in Libya with arms. So we have some sort of ground action, not sanctioned by the UN. It's on Egypt's own decision, and it perhaps reflects Egypt's embrace of democracy and wanting it to spread to Libya.
That's Clay Jones. He's chief editorial writer for the Christian Science Monitor. I understand that Peter Canellos is now on the line. Peter, are you there?
I am.
Hey, it's so good to have you. Peter, of course, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Chime in here on the situation in Libya. We were going to bring the story home to Massachusetts. Senator John Kerry has long been pushing for a no-fly zone before the White House was. What do you make of Kerry's prominence, I guess, being a little bit out in front here, Peter?
Well, I think John Kerry is getting more and more confident, both of his relationship with the president and even, you know, it's a sign of confidence that he can disagree with the president openly in some ways or sort of push the president along openly, and also just in his own stature as the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I must say I feel as though this is a move that is fraught with a lot of risks for the United States, and I don't think that it's as clear an equation as if you want democracy in Libya, you have to participate in this mission. And I think Obama was right to be quite reluctant. I do think that the humanitarian, or the case for humanitarian intervention, has been made more forcefully in the last few days, and that it would be appropriate for the United States to participate in a mission against Gaddafi. But I do think that it's got some risks.
Mm. And what do you make of this announcement of a ceasefire?
I think it's a ploy by Gaddafi to try to have the international will, which has now reached this crescendo, kind of peter out over time. At which point he'll continue to reassert control over the country, probably in a very bloody way. So. I don't see it as some kind of a sincere change of heart on Gaddafi's part or commitment to nonviolence.
Mm. Well, let's move on to Japan and the nuclear reactor crisis there. Today, nuclear engineers continue to try to control the damaged nuclear reactors at the Fukushima power station. Clay, we're interested in having you in here because you reported from Asia and specifically Japan for many years. You spent a lot of time in Japan. What do you make of how the Japanese have responded to the earthquake and this particular nuclear reactor crisis?
Well, in typical fashion, they've been very stoic. They put up with a lot. They have a lot of stamina. It's been admirable to see how they've reacted. It's a shame that a country that suffered atomic bomb now has to deal with atomic release, radiation release. Mm. So it's disheartening. They've made a huge commitment to nuclear power because it's a country with few natural resources. And they, like the United States and other countries, have to decide, do they continue to build more nuclear plants, both for power needs, but also if they see that as the answer to global warming.
Yeah. Now, your time in Japan, you lived through an earthquake or two over there, correct?
Well, there's an average of 30 to 40 significant earthquakes every year. I interviewed some of the survivors of the great 1923 earthquake, where it just basically destroyed Tokyo. And ever since then, Japan has been preparing for a big quake. Unfortunately, they prepared for one near Tokyo and not the one up in the Northeast.
Hmm. Peter, as Clay mentioned, the human toll, the disaster, a massive one over there. How do you feel the country has been responding to this event?
Well, I think the country has been responding well, and it's a show of character. And I happen to have just been traveling in Japan and came back a week before the earthquake, and so seeing the country that I had just sort of viewed through an observer's eyes respond this way has been impressive, but also has been sad. I do think that some of the flaws in the Japanese system are appearing, particularly the deference that the government gives to power companies. As an American, you would feel as though you would be clamoring for answers much more strongly than the Japanese have been, although some certainly have. And hoping that there would be outside regulators playing a stronger role than they appear to be playing in Japan right now.
Mm. Now, the events, the situation at the Fukushima nuclear plants are being felt, are having effects here in the U.S. Let's listen to President Obama talking about this yesterday.
Nuclear power is also an important part of our own energy future, along with renewable sources like wind, solar, natural gas, and clean coal. Our nuclear power plants have undergone exhaustive study and have been declared safe for any number of extreme contingencies. But when we see a crisis like the one in Japan, we have a responsibility to learn from this event and to draw from those lessons to ensure the safety and security of our people. That's why I've asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to do a comprehensive review of the safety of our domestic nuclear plants in light of the natural disaster that unfolded in Japan.
So, Peter Kanellis, this hits close to home. We have two plants here in New England, one in Plymouth, Mass., one in Vermont. They're both approaching 40 years of age. They're both seeking new 20-year licenses. Do you think we need to reevaluate our nuclear power future in light of these events in Japan?
I really do think that we need to. The events in Japan, most nuclear advocates would have said were totally impossible to happen. Things that were assured to be 100% reliable containment vessels cracked, backup systems didn't work. You can't look at an experience like that and not say, let's look at every aspect of the Pilgrim plant or Vermont Yankee and You know, everything from the containment vessels to backup systems to evacuation plans, et cetera. I mean, I think all of that needs to be done.
Hmm. What do you think, Clay? What's your response? Do you think the president sort of struck the right balance there?
I do. I think part of the problem is ever since Three Mile Island, we haven't been building new plants. As a result, we keep extending the life of current plants, and therefore that raises even greater safety issues. Meanwhile, engineers have come up with better and safer designs, and yet they're not allowed to be built. So at some point, we either have to decide to stick with the present plants or build new ones and hope that there's more safety features built into those.
Of course, it's all a question of whether Wall Street investors want to shell out the money to do it, and this certainly doesn't help that prospect.
Well, that raises the idea of a government guarantee for the insurance of these plants. To back up Wall Street's.
Mm. But, you know, Anthony, as I understand, I mean, there's already a law, the Price-Anderson Act, that limits liability for people building nuclear power plants. There also are some government loan guarantees in play. You know, there's a question how far the government should go in promoting something that Wall Street says is not viable economically. And the reason is because of all these safety measures that need to be put in and that we've seen good cause for needing. So,
well, let's make a transition that's a little bumpy here. But speaking of international news, Governor Deval Patrick returned earlier this week from his trip to Israel and the UK, where he was working to drum up business and he hopes jobs for Massachusetts. While he was away, Fidelity Investment announced they're moving 1,100 jobs from Marlboro out of state to Rhode Island and New Hampshire. Here's Governor Deval Patrick speaking today.
Let me just say something about the Fidelity announcement. I'm not just disappointed, I'm frustrated, because the leadership of Fidelity has been in my office within the period when they were supposedly teed up to move on this decision to move jobs to Rhode Island. They are in regular contact with the Secretary of Housing and Economic Development, and not once did they give us a chance to compete for those jobs. And we can compete and will compete, but we have to have information.
So, Peter Canales, what do you think? A serious blow to the governor's efforts to drum up jobs here?
Well, clearly he's very angry about it, and clearly it did embarrass him at a time when he had just been overseas trying to drum up economic activity. I think there are two other factors, though, that have to be considered. One is Fidelity is a very quirky company. It's privately owned. Ned Johnson is, you know, there are stories all around town of his somewhat impulsive actions. So, you know, I don't know how much it means that there's a feud going on between the governor and Fidelity, given Fidelity's overall behavior. And the other thing is that these jobs are going to Rhode Island and New Hampshire. You know, our show is called Radio Boston. I guess we advocate for Massachusetts, but, you know, we kind of want New Hampshire and Rhode Island to get jobs, too. So it's not the end of the world benefiting.
They're part of the broader neighborhood. We should note as well that this week the jobless rate in Massachusetts did tick down to 8.2%. I think we added something like 15,000 jobs, so it wasn't all grim news this week. So we're going to move on to our hubbub section. This is the section of our week in review where we talk about those little pieces of news that kind of flew under the radar, and my co-host Meghna's back with us. So, Meghna.
Okay, well,
give us your hubbub.
Actually, given the fact that lots of kids are wondering where they're going to be going to college, and it's the sort of college admission season, there's this great story about the most recent administration of the SAT, and I'm getting sweaty just thinking about it because the flashbacks are still coming back to me, but apparently one of the essay questions had to do with reality television, and the question was along the lines of how authentic can these shows be when producers design challenges for the participants and editors alter filmed scenes, and apparently online discussion boards were full of panicked seniors who were like, I don't watch reality TV. I've been told I should never watch it because I'm supposed to be focusing on school and stuff. I had no idea how to answer the question. So I'm sure that those same students will do quite well, though, on the SAT.
But just
shouldn't
they
have much to worry
just
about.
Just what they need, more things to worry about in
the
SAT
situation season. On the SAT, exactly.
Peter Canellos, your hubbub.
I was going to mention the 110-pound light fixture that fell in early February in the four Big Dig Tunnel. This is enough to strike reasonable fear in all the motorists, including yours truly, who drive through those tunnels all the time. The one problem was that state transportation officials, instead of alerting the public and letting letting them decide whether to drive through it, did a whole lot of checks and determined that things were okay, which is fine, but they should have alerted the public.
They should have alerted the public. Yeah, I think there seems to be consensus around that now, and even the Patrick administration is admitting that perhaps better notification would have been in order. Clay Jones, how about you?
Well, I can't compete with falling lamps, but this is a I was interested in the terrorist squirrel in Bennington, Vermont that started attacking people. And not only that, there's speculation that the squirrel might have been raised by humans. It was just kind of picking out certain humans to attack so it could protect the humans that raised it.
I've heard same things happening in occasionally in Boston Common, that squirrels jump out of trees and land on people's heads.
Yeah,
just one more detail. I caught that story too, and this squirrel was actually landing on people, and they were sort of brushing it off their arms and their legs.
Jumps on its back and starts biting. Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me of my pet flying squirrel that I used to have.
All right. Well, here's my hubbub. It comes from that crazy world of it's never too soon to start gunning for the Ivy Leagues. And our producer, Dan Mozzie, found this. It comes from the New York Daily News. And so here it is. There's a woman named Nicole Impresha from New York City. She's suing the York Avenue Preschool. It's a private preschool in New York because she claims they may have damaged her 4-year-old daughter's chances of getting into an elite private school and an Ivy League institution. The problem apparently was the preschool claimed that they would help their students prepare for the ERB tests, but instead they put them in a room and let them play with toys and learn the shapes. And
gasp! So, how dare they?
So she's pulled her kid out of this school. She wants $19,000 back, which was the tuition. It's also a class action suit. But her lawyer says that all is not lost. For the record, the child will get into an Ivy League school, the preschool notwithstanding. So that's my hubbub, and we're going to end it right there. And thank you all. Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. As always, thank you. It's great having you.
Thank you.
And Clayton Jones, thanks for braving our fire today. He's the chief editorial writer for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks for coming
in. Thank you.
Stay with us.
Because up next, is feminism the best or worst thing ever to happen to American women? Phyllis Schlafly's niece knows what side of the divide she falls on, and she'll explain why. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.